The Off the Ball Podcast Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're very welcome to the Borgosh Energy Theatre. We're live with thanks to Heineken, official worldwide partner to Rugby World Cup 2019 in Japan. On stage tonight, Rugby World Cup winners Michael Lina and Bobby Skinstad, British and Irish Lion Malcolm O'Kelly, Danny O'Reilly from the Coronas, Mr. Ross O'Carroll Kelly, Paul Howard, National Treasures Brian O'Driscoll and Keith Wood. But first, give it up for your host, a Mayo man who's finally broken the curse after 12 long years coming second to Joe Malloy. He is your 2019 IMRO Sports Broadcaster of the Year. He used to work in an abattoir, true story. Now he just slaughters the competition. It's Nathan, Nate Dog Murphy.
Good evening, Dublin. How are we all doing? Wow, that is a big crowd. How are we? We're not going to spend all night talking about the fact I am the Sports Broadcaster of the Year, but if our guests want to bring it up, I'm certainly not going to stop them, so I'll just warn you in advance. We all right? Are we worried about Saturday morning and the All Blacks?
No.
Good, good, because there's literally nothing in our history to suggest that we may bottle it come a World Cup quarterfinal. Nothing whatsoever. We have a brilliant night lined up. We are here tonight with thanks to our friends at Heineken, official worldwide partner of Rugby World Cup Japan 2019. And just to let you know that before the end of the show, one of you guys out there is going to win a pair of tickets to the 2020 Heineken Champions Cup Final. It is in Marseille with flights and accommodation. Yes. Have we any Munster fans in the house? Well, you guys should listen up, because this is probably the only reason you're going to have to go. I didn't think there'd be that many Munster people here. I thought I'd be safe with all the Leinster folk, but the Munster people have travelled, it seems. So that was badly misjudged. So how do you win? Well, it's pretty simple. Just tweet us using the hashtag OTBBGET. That is right up there above me. So use that. If you're in the crowd, include a selfie, and you could be joining us on stage at the end of the show for a very special crappy quiz for a chance to win a trip to the 2020 Heineken Champions Cup Final in Marseille. We will also be rewarding the more entertaining comments with the chance to win some cold pints of Heineken or Heineken Zero, and we have some official Heineken rugby merchandise to come as well. We have a brilliant night lined up. We're going to spend a lot of time looking ahead to the weekend's quarterfinals, to that clash with the All Blacks. We have some bona fide legends with us. We have two men who know all about winning not just quarterfinals, but actual World Cups. We have Bobby Skinstad of South Africa and Michael Lina of Australia are with us tonight. Big Malcolm O'Kelly is here. We have the man behind Ross O'Carroll Kelly, Paul Howard. Danny O'Reilly from the Coronas is going to join us. But first, let me introduce my two beautiful co-hosts. They are very much Irish legends. Give it up for Keith Wood and Brian O'Driscoll.
All right.
How are we? How are we?
Very excellent, thank you.
So it's been quite a couple of weeks, Keith.
Oh, it's been amazing. The rugby has just been
astounding. No, I'm not on about the rugby, Keith. I'm on about my victory at the Sports Broadcaster of the Year. Two of them. Two of them. I really don't want to go on about it, Keith. But
is that Joe's hand trying to prize the second one away from you?
I think it is. Has anyone seen Joe Malloy in recent weeks? I literally...
Who's Joe Malloy? He's dead
exactly,
to us.
Exactly.
He is so in the past.
But listen, I got to be honest. I was absolutely honoured because, Keith, you know, there's nothing better than being honoured by your peers at being the very best at what you do.
No, it is pretty fantastic, actually. It's amazing.
Is it possible to explain?
It's a great feeling, actually. It is about as good as it gets.
And Brian,
do you know what? Being
it's
nominated,
great to have you here. It's great to have you here.
being nominated is just as good as winning the actual main event. So.
Yeah, that's what I said for the last decade. So you're off to Japan in the morning.
Tomorrow morning, yeah, first thing. 19 days. And looking forward to it.
Is this the first time you'll have been to a World Cup and stayed past the quarterfinal?
Hey!
I'm sorry.
Now that
that's the end of it.
Now that you've had your joke, your anti-monster, you're slagging him off.
I'm all out of friends right now. I'm all out of friends. 19 days.
Do you know what? I went to the World Cup final in 99, having played in it as well. And there were no flights from Dublin to Cardiff, so I drove. We got the boat, myself and my dad got the boat, drove across through the valleys of Wales, couldn't find accommodation there, so then had to drive another 4 hours back to Aberystwyth to actually stay in a B&B. What an experience that was. But yeah, so I've been to a World Cup final. Have you?
Well, funny you mention it, Brian. I was at the last World Cup final. We have an answer for everything up here. So we finally got there. Ireland at a World Cup quarterfinal. A little bit more topsy-turvy over the last few weeks than we would have imagined. It is the All Blacks. It doesn't get any bigger. How do you think we're fixed?
Well, we definitely haven't peaked yet.
Nervous laughter.
I don't know. I think it's... I don't know whether it's the player in me that I feel surprisingly optimistic considering what we've seen so far. I definitely feel that the All Blacks wouldn't have wanted us in a quarterfinal, and I think that gives you a lot of hope as well. It's the first World Cup that we've ever gone to where we've beaten every team in the tournament. So that's definitely a hoodoo off our backs. I just feel as though it'll be tight. I'm not saying we're going to definitely win, but I think we are going to run them really close. And even you can tell Steve Hansen's already a little bit nervous, saying, oh, yeah? Joe Schmidt does his study and maybe we can trip him up in that. You know, they've got a newfound respect for this Irish team. And a lot of, five or six of these players have beaten the All Blacks three times in the last 3 or 4 years with Ireland and the Lions. So I give us a good shot. I think it'll be a one-score game. I just hope we're on the right side of it.
Keith, how much have you enjoyed it so far?
Yeah, I haven't got excited yet. That's the other thing. And maybe that's some of the confidence that's been built over the last number of years. And I know we were poor against Japan, and there's no kind of counting against that fact. We were pretty average, and yet the only game that was really going to be important for us was the quarterfinal. And all we thought we were going to be playing against South Africa, and we're not, right? So, but this is the game where it really starts for us. And the idea was to try and get Ireland to get themselves in a position to where they would be at the top of the game. They're not yet, but this is the chance. And if the win comes, you're then looking to see where you grow from there. And in a lot of cases, in a lot of times past, you're just trying to make certain that you get out of the group first and then see exactly what happens. And I know we even go back to 2003, we thought we had a good chance to kind of progress further. And but everything has been in this one. Well, obviously, they're going to qualify for a quarterfinal. They're going to go and play whoever they're going to. I just think this is the game for them. This is what everything has been for the last 4 years. If we perform very well, I think we actually have a substantial chance. And if we don't perform, we're going to get badly beaten. And that's it. But this is what all the work has been for 4 years, is to get to this one point. So I think it's been shadow boxing for the last 3 or 4 weeks. I haven't been overly excited or interested with it. When people got really excited with stuff, I haven't really cared too much about it because I knew this day was going to come. Now I can't wait for the day, you know. And I'm hoping for and expecting an extraordinary performance.
All right. We're going to delve a lot deeper into Ireland against New Zealand a little bit later in the show. But let's get our first guests out on stage. Two proper legends of the game, Michael Leine and Bobby Stinstad. How are we?
Hi. Good, thanks. Hello, everyone. Nice to be here.
No, stay nice. Close if you like.
Sorry?
Stay close.
Nice shoes, mate. Nice shoes.
Enjoying your time in Dublin?
Always. Great place to come here. The customs let me in today, which was quite nice of them. Normally they don't let me in after 91, so it was nice of them to do that, yeah.
Yeah, there is a reason why they don't let you in.
I know.
Let's get straight to it.
They tell me every time. You won't be coming in today, Mr. Leine. You broke our hearts in 91. How many times have I heard that? Sorry, by the way, sorry.
Do you want to see it one more time?
These guys are the bosses. You want
you
to,
want
see,
to
it?
See it one more time? Let's get the good stuff first and then we can watch that. All right, let's play it.
Australian pop got up and hit the rock again, so and cause a knock-on. Tremendous play by some of these Irish players.
Curtis in midfield, Staples in the line. Jack Clark with the race with Campisi. Clark has won it. Clark feeds on to Hamilton. Gordon Hamilton's going to go all the way. Hamilton for Ireland. And Hamilton will score. A wonderful try by Gordon Hamilton, the Ballymena back row forward. And Lansdowne Road has come alive, absolutely engulfed. Outside the wall, the referee Jim Fleming right there, but gives the ball to Australia. Australia it was who was going forward.
Yes, Australia will keep possession here. They are absolutely desperate. I mean, if they get a penalty, they're only going to draw this game, and it'll go to extra time. But a try will win it for them. And here they are in excellent tacky position.
3.5 minutes to go. Australia trail by 3 points. Slattery, Liner, Horan and Roebuck in there. Campisi, Campisi with 3 yards to go. Tackled. And Australia have scored. Lansdowne Road has gone quiet, but Australia has scored. And it's Liner, Michael Liner, who's been credited with a try.
Go on, go on. Give him the round of applause. Yeah. So you spent, what, 28 years apologising for that, essentially?
Just about, yes, yeah. It was one of Campo's better passes, wasn't it? Rolled it along the ground.
What's going through your head when Gordon Hamilton scores that try and the Irish supporters are converging on the pitch and there's this just this wildness around Lansdowne Road, and like the upset is on? It's worth remembering like where Ireland were at that stage. They were struggling to win games in the Five Nations. They've been beaten in a series over Namibia in the warm-up. They were absolute rank outsiders. Are you thinking we're going to be on the wrong end of a major shock here?
I wasn't thinking that at the time. There was a bit of panic that set in, I guess, and I was acting captain at that moment because Nick Far Jones, our captain, had gone off in the first 5 minutes of the game. And I guess the first thing I did was to go to Jim Fleming, the referee, because there was no clocks in those days on the pitch. You couldn't see how long to go. So I asked Jim, you know, how long to go? Because if there was no time left, it didn't matter what I said to the team, you know. So he said there was 4 minutes. So between running from him back to the team sort of congregated under the post there, I had to come up with something to say to them. And in situations like that, it's more about, you know, people sort of don't panic, don't worry, you know, those sort of things. And the don't's a very negative word. And comments like that don't actually mean anything. So I had to come up with something meaningful. And I sort of had to keep it pretty simple. Pressure situations like that are people don't take a lot in, and particularly front row forwards on the pitch, they don't take a lot in at any time. But when it's stressful like that. So basically, I got there and I said, guys, there's 4 minutes to go. So that was a fact. We have enough time, and this is what we're going to do. We're going to kick long, get down into their territory. They'll kick it out. We'll have a line out. And from that moment, you know, the backs will do their bit. So just secure the ball. And I left them with something really simple in that if you're in doubt and you've got the ball, you don't know what to do, hold onto the thing and run towards the opposition goal line. As I said, there was prop forwards on the team. But the reason for that, and you saw... Sorry?
Thanks for clarifying. It wasn't hookers.
Yeah, that's the base. But you see there that those highlights we saw. And Campo, we did a move that brought Campo back inside Tim Horan on the cutback. And there were two reasons we did that and called that move. One, we'd scored from it in the first half. So that's a good reason to do it again. Secondly, it brought Campo back towards close to the forwards. So if he did get tackled, we'd be able to secure the ball. And the rules back in those days, as the commentator rightly said there, was that if you're going forward, you take the ball in, you're going forward, you get the put in. And Campo was normally like most wingers, or most backs actually, we'd get tackled, we'd throw the ball away and run away and let the forwards do what they do. But if you watch that closely, Campo actually stayed in there and he started pulling towards the opposition goal line. You know, forwards hit him and then we got the put in. So I thought if Campo's listening, you know, most of them were. And then we got the scrum right underneath the Irish post there, and Timmy Horan came up to me and said, drop goal, which would have given us a draw. Now, the honest sort of answer to that was I didn't really know the rules, that a draw would have put us through because we'd scored more tries. I didn't know that at the time. So being a good captain I am, I said, let's go for the win here. And we'd been working on a move, which was the one we did, which sort of... We saw the Irish defence were in such... They aligned and did things in such a way. So we did this move and we practised it time and time again. And I just said, no, we're going to do this. And to Timmy and the rest of the team's credit, yes, let's do it. And ended up getting out to Campo. And my role in that move was just to follow the ball along and support if it broke down anywhere and be on hand when it did. And Campo, when he got 10 yards out, I mean, he scores. He scores every time. And this time he got dragged down, and I just happened to be there, and as I said, one of his better passes, and over I went. And the thing that got me at the moment was that I thought there was something wrong because there was this silence. Silence. And I just heard a couple of our players sort of jumping up and down, and I thought there's something gone wrong, but no, I was looking at the grass on that side, and I think that's a nice piece of grass right there. And so that was it. But that was a real moment in the World Cup for us in 91 that actually we were put under pressure and we knew we could go up another gear. And next week we took on the All Blacks and I really took them on in the first half and won really well. So it was a real moment where our World Cup sort of journey changed. That's the short answer, by the way.
For you to have that level of composure when you look and there's 4 minutes left and... like, this is the moment. It's a World Cup quarterfinal. It's do or die. To be actually able to think straight, to be able to give that sort of instruction. You're what, 6, 7 years into your international career at that stage?
Yeah.
Like, was that a sort of coming together of difficult moments, of missed kicks, of criticism, of introspection, of all bringing you to this moment of actually, I'm the calmest man in this stadium right now?
Yeah, I don't know if I was the calmest, but... I guess you don't have an option. You don't have a choice. You know, you've either, as a captain, you've either got to decide what you do. And I guess experience, I think it was 8 or 9 years that I'd been playing international rugby by then and had a lot of tests under my belt and that sort of thing. So experience comes to the fore. And if you can be quite calm and think how long to go, what are we going to do, what's the simple thing to do, you know, and just trust what we've practiced, etc., and go through those processes. I guess Clive Woodward used it a lot, the thinking clearly under pressure, and that's a pretty good example of it. And, yeah, you know, it was. I didn't think, you know, now be calm. It was more about, okay, we've got to do something, and I've got to do it, so what do we do?
Did you have a realisation that World Cup of how good David Campese was? You know, yeah. He played a lot throughout the 80s. Was it an opportunity... to get the ball to him as often as possible. Is that what you thought as a backline and as a team? Because sometimes it's difficult to convince forwards that, but as backline, you realise who your best strike runner is. But you know, sometimes getting that message across, was that definitely a policy of yours throughout the World Cup? We saw it in the semi-final then. You know, he scored spectacular tries and had magic touches. Mm. So was that a focus in advance of going into it?
Yeah, and it wasn't something we'd sit down at a team meeting and go, you know, get the ball to Campo. It was... I mean, I'd called most of the backline, well, I called all the backline plays, and as a caller of those moves, you sort of thought, your first thought was, you know, how do I get Campo involved in this, whether he be a decoy or the ultimate user of the ball? And during that World Cup, you're right, he was something special. I mean, he was really special, and plus, when he's got the ball in his hands, he tends not to talk too much, so it's better to have the ball in his hands. but he was brilliant that World Cup. And you talk about the two tries we scored against, well, he created against the All Blacks. They weren't set plays at all. They were just off-the-cuff moves. The first one involved, there was a line-out over to the left, our ball, and I was supposed to call some sort of move. And the thing was, the ball came in really quickly and I hadn't called a play. And basically, I just took the ball up. And we know that's not a play because I would never do that. I wouldn't take the ball into the middle of the All Blacks, that's for sure. But I did it. And then Campo from the right-hand side wing, we'd never done this before, but for some reason, he decided to come all the way back, get the pass off the halfback and score in the corner. And it was just one of those things that happened. The second one was very similar. It was a midfield scrum around halfway, and I was waiting to... I was going to kick the ball either right or left, depending on where the fullback went. And I saw that he was a long way back, and so I just put this little chip kick in. It wasn't called or anything like that, but the bounce got lucky, and Campo came through and threw a miraculous pass to Timmy. And one of Timmy's great strengths, it wasn't so much Campo's great pass, it was Timmy's communication. I mean, he let you know when he wanted the ball, you know. And that was they were off the cuff things. But Campo in that World Cup, he was something special. He really was.
That play was called the moment of the World Cup in 91, the try that Timmy scored. I spoke to Campo about it, and he said, "Well, sure, I ran at the touchline. There's no way in the world Timmy's going to run and follow me into touch." He had to know what I was going to do.
Yeah.
So he had a presumption that other players would see the game as fast or as far ahead as he did. He said, the second I ran to the touchline, I was going to have to throw the ball back inside. Timmy would know that.
Yeah.
I asked Timmy, he said, I didn't. No. You know?
I thought he was going to run up.
But I tell my kids now, I've got three boys, and, you know, get the ball to the best player and follow him, and you'll score. And that was sort of our attitude a little bit, you know, with Campo. Get the ball to him and follow him, and you'll do well. He was actually a really great player. I played with him first in 1982. I was only 11, but he was a bit old. We played in the Australian under 21s together, and even back then he was just a great guy to play with. You get the ball to him and he'd make things happen. Defensively, a little bit different, as you saw with Gordon there.
Obviously, Seaton probably is a little bit of a maverick, but I know you talk about him as well in his preparation and his work ethic, that particularly in that amateur era, he was probably better prepared than anyone on that team.
It's very true. He was. Yeah, he did. He trained really hard and, you know, went to the gym every day and all that sort of thing. Back in those days, the gym was something that, you know, you called your son. It wasn't something you went to. So he was... And he was very, very professional in the way he prepared for the game. So it was no accident, but he was a freak, really, as a player. That's enough of Campo now, by the way.
When he got to the end of his career, towards the end, when I was starting, he'd lost a lot of his pace. Do you remember? He was still playing on the wing. Mm. But he developed a kick on his left and right boot, and he could kick it straight down the tram lines, 60 yards down it. So, and then he'd run after it, because he couldn't run there anymore. But anytime any team put Yee under pressure, he just seemed to kick the ball 70 yards straight down the channel. And he must have practiced, because he never really kicked a huge amount except to the last two or three years of his career. Would that be about right?
No, you're right. He kicked more than anyone in the Australian team, and for somebody that's known as a runner. And I remember I had a bit of an argument with him at one stage about... I was in Brisbane. I'm from Brisbane. He was living in Sydney at the time. And Sydney Morning Herald on the back page had, you know, Campo, you know, blames Liner for lack of ball and all this sort of thing. And so I rang him up and said, mate, what are you talking about? He said, I don't read the papers. You shouldn't read them either. And I said, look, you're the world record try scorer. I must have passed you the ball a few times, you know. But after that, he did develop his kicking game and kicked it more than anyone. But he was like... the professional sort of outlook he had. He practiced a lot. It wasn't a mistake.
That was some backline, though. You know, you look at Far Jones at nine, you at out half, Timmy Horan at inside centre, Jason Little at outside centre, David Campese self-centred. Like, he kind of did his own thing. I remember seeing in that... that semi-final game was the first time that I've ever seen someone not face the haka. Yeah. Everyone else faced the haka, and he just practiced his punting.
Yeah. Keepy uppy.
Yeah.
He was kicking it to me. I was back there with him as well.
Were you, yeah?
No, it was one of those things that the haka back then was... It was all this talk. There's always this talk about the haka and what we're going to do and all that sort of thing. And, you know, it's the simplest and the best thing to do for the haka is just pay it respects and get on with it. You know, various coaches and press and all that sort of thing make such a big thing about it back then. And
that works on radio, doesn't it? Sorry, I was throwing a piece of grass up in the air. It was a great thing to do for the haka, wasn't it, Brian?
Checking the
wind. We've only seen that happen once.
Strange. How did the first 5 minutes go for you after you...
5 minutes, the lucky bastards.
I forgot about that.
When you think back through your... World Cup memories, obviously winning it is the undoubted highlight, but when you think of the other special games that you played in the semi-final in 87 against France and Serge Blanco breaking your heart, even going then to 95 and playing against South Africa in their opening game at Newlands, and like, just the atmosphere, what are the really special moments that stand out?
Well, you mentioned 87, and that was, you know, compared to what we see in the big road show that Rugby World Cup is now, 87 was amateur hour, really. It was nobody really knew whether it was going to work, you know, whether Northern Hemisphere teams going to turn up. It was in New Zealand and Australia. Communications weren't what they are now. And anyway, one of the great games I played in, even though we lost it, was the semi-final against France at Concord Oval in Sydney. And the lead went back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And Campo ended up scoring a try with about 5 minutes, 10 minutes to go over in the right-hand corner. I think it was a try where he broke the Australian or the world record try scoring record at that time. Anyway, right in the corner and put us 1 point behind, and I had to kick the goal to take us 1 point in front. And in those days, so I come back right on the sideline, the stand behind me and all that sort of thing, and in those days we didn't have kicking tees. They hadn't been invented back then, and because the ground was pretty hard, we used to bring a little ball boy, 10-year-old kid, used to come out with a bucket of sand and give you that, and you'd put that down. So this kid comes out, and I'm sort of there looking up like this, and he gives me it, and I put the thing down. And all part of my routine was always to say, thanks, thank you. And so away he goes, and then I thought he went away, and I was looking at naming the ball and what have you, and I see his legs, he's still standing here. And I look up this little kid, bear in mind that it was 10 minutes to go, World Cup semi-final, 1 point down, etc. I've got to kick the kick. You know, a lot of pressure. And this kid, I look up at him and go, he looks at me and goes, pretty important kick this. It's true. And I went, yeah, I know. And he goes, well, you better get it. And so anyway, I did get it, and I'll never forget running back along, and he's running along the sideline going like this, you know. And albeit to no sort of reward, because Serge Blanco scored a magnificent try in the corner right at the death to knock us out. And but then, you know, my worst memory wasn't actually the loss. It was sitting in the dressing room after that. And we didn't know as players back then that there was such a thing as a third and fourth playoff. We didn't know. And we thought, oh, you know, our tournament's over, OK, we'll go home. But then our manager came in and said, bags down at 9 o'clock in the foyer tomorrow morning. We said, what for? You've got to go to Rotorua to play Wales in the third and fourth playoff. That was the low moment of my career right there. And we honestly didn't know we had to do that. And wish we didn't have to go, because we lost that one as well.
I'm wary of giving updates from the football match, because Switzerland are winning 1-0, and it might put a bit of a downer on the night. But if Ireland score, we will most certainly let you know. Bobby, I mentioned 95 there, and like that was Michael's swan song from international rugby, not just from the World Cup. Obviously, this incredible couple of months in South African history. As a, what were you, 18, 19-year-old at that stage, what are your memories of its importance and how you kind of took it all in?
Well, first of all, thanks very much for having me. It's great to be here back in Dublin, and delighted to be here and to listen to one of my all-time heroes, because 95 World Cup, I went to go and watch Michael and the all-conquering Australian team train at Stellenbosch. They came out to Stellenbosch, I'm not sure if it was for the wine tours or the rugby training pitches, but we were all students at Stellenbosch at that time, and they had a couple of training sessions in a row, and it was really special. You know, I was born in Zimbabwe and had come down to South Africa, was studying in Stellenbosch, and the Rugby World Cup for us was a re-entry into the stage of world sport post-apartheid and post, you know, a sort of a hiatus away from all international sport. And my dad was a sort of a very liberal anti-government protester at that stage. So this was like, we were all seriously excited about it. We queued up for tickets. I mean, the opening game at Newlands, we'd queued through the night, and we were there, painted faces with the South African flag on, watching the opening game of the World Cup and South Africa. Nelson Mandela and his role and all that kind of thing. We lived through that. It was an incredible time. I mean, a great privilege to even just be a small part of it, just watching from the outside.
Were you at the final?
No, I didn't make it to the final. I played with a guy called Fritz van Heerden, who was he made it into the South African squad. I was lucky enough to play in a Stellenbosch first team as a youngster, and he got sort of plucked out of that into Western Province and then straight into that World Cup squad. So he promised me some tickets if I got to Durban. So we hitchhiked from Stellenbosch to Durban, which is about 2,200 kilometers. And there were four of us.
Pretty safe in South Africa.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so you'd have been
no,
grand.
Well, exactly. It was South Africa, so middle of the night was the best time to do it. And National Highway. And then what we did was, because there were four of us and nobody would stop for four of us, we took turns in hiding in the bushes, and then one would put his thumb out, and then the other three would run out saying like we're also here for the lift, so nobody stopped for us. So we did a lot of walking, but we eventually got a lift from a guy. We stopped at a sort of overnight petrol station, one of those 24-hour stations, and the guy gave us a lift all the way through. My folks lived in Durban. We stayed there and we watched the semi-final, and then didn't make it. We watched the semi-final at a Varsity flat in Pietermaritzburg, actually. Not quite the same as the Ellis Park with the plane going over, but we did have a massive party in Stellenbosch. In fact, we scored scored the drop goal in the extra time, and we had a pylon, you know, the multi-person pylons. And there was a girl at the bottom who we had to take to hospital. so we missed the celebration, but the rest of it was outstanding.
They know how to have a good time, don't they?
So it was memorable, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
It's obviously shocking to think that four of that 95 South African winning side are no longer with us now after the passing just in the last couple of months of Chester Williams and James Small.
It is. It's really sad. I mean, it's been a run of really bad luck. I mean, I think, the earliest memory for me was we lost Ruben Kruger, who was a loose forward as I was growing up that everybody wanted to be like or try and play like, big and strong and a real leader in his team. And, you know, it just carried on. There's been one or two guys who've also had illnesses. Krainer Otto recovered from a brain injury. When you look at, you know, MS and what's happening to Dodie Weir, and it's clear and present, and it's around you. It's harder to deal with. You know, the Joost van der Veste as an illness was really badly taken in South Africa because he was such a sort of a prime athlete at the height of his career, and then the difficulties that he went through. And Chester Williams was probably the most surprising. I mean, a massive cardiac arrest. As a youngster, he did so much for South Africa. I mean, Chester was probably the first guy who I think South Africa could actually look at the rest of the world and say, you know, on merit, this guy's come into the team. We've had the background that we've had as South Africa in politics and sports have mixed over so many years, but this has turned into a national hero overnight. You know, he scored four tries in the quarterfinals against Samoa. And really, although he already played exceptionally well before that, he announced himself onto the world stage with four, you know, two finishes that you would expect most wings to have a go at, and two finishes that not many wings would manage. And he smashed them over, and then played for South Africa for a long time. You know, I was really lucky because he played sevens rugby as well, and I played with him, and then later on he coached. So we had a great relationship, and it was an incredibly sad time. Western Province had a sort of a funeral at Newlands, which has been the cradle of rugby for a long time, and where he played, and really sad day.
What sort of character was he?
Just the world's nicest guy. In an absolute sort of heart out there kind of way. He had the most intricate and difficult signature I've ever seen. And it was sort of a big C, and then the H, and then the E, and the S, and the T, and the E. And then he started with the W for the Williams. And, you know, you're doing one of those signing sessions. You go, okay, let's go. And there's a pile about this big next to him. But he just went through every single one. He would stop. Hold on. How do you spell your name? Okay. Tony. Is that with Tony with an I? Hold on. Boom. And then start with the Chester Williams. And with a gold pen that was running out, and we've got to get another one. And then, but I mean, he would never, ever be rushed on anything like that. And I think many, many kids benefited from the fact that he had so much time for so many people. And we miss him a lot.
He was a shy guy, too, wasn't he?
Oh, very much so. I mean shy.
For a guy who was, you know, there was a lot of criticism at the time when he got picked because they said he wasn't being picked on merit and he'd been injured for a while and they rushed him back from injury. Do you remember he was heavily strapped to play in that World Cup? Mm. But he became that, you know, but with Mandela, with Francois, and then Chester became
the icon, didn't he? Yeah. You know, actually, I mean, the story, you're 99% right. What happened was he wasn't even going to make the World Cup, and then the winger, Peter Hendricks, got a red card. So you were allowed to bring in two extra players, if people had either a sort of tournament-ending injury or a red card, and you could replace, like they can now. You know, I think once you get to the, what are the squads now? About 900 people. But yeah, you're allowed to bring in one or two more, and Chester Williams came in after that, after the game where South Africa had the first red card ever of a World
Canada,
Cup against Canada. Yeah. So you're right. He came in late into that World Cup, and he just, you know, the team, I think, picked up on that momentum, and it became an incredible, I mean, he was inundated. Anytime there was a session where the team were you know, together or in a public place, I mean, he was the guy that they just queued through the back of the place to see him.
How did that World Cup change you as a person when you see a momentous moment like Mandela and Pienaar, and you know, not long out of apartheid? You know, you're coming up through, you know, I presume private schooling and then into college. I don't know what, you know, your group of friends are like, or what, you know, who you're hanging with or associating with, but has... What, you know, what's the opinion of the, you know, white educated man rugby player in South Africa at the time versus, you know, what we saw back in those days through the early 90s, the horror that was apartheid and the issues that the country had?
You know, Drika, it's amazing when you put it as a question like that. It probably wasn't something that I addressed personally at the time, but it's definitely something that's informed me on my career afterwards and in some of the decisions that I took at the time. Like I said, my dad and my folks were incredibly liberal. My dad came from a Scandinavian background. My mum was born in Carlingford, County Louth. You know, so I made it in easier than Michael Liner did today with my Irish passport. But, you know, we were Southern African. My dad practiced medicine in what was Rhodesia fought in the war against Bob Mugabe. We know how that went. We then came down to South Africa, and he was doing exactly the same thing, practicing medicine. So, you know, he just said to me, I was sort of 18 and a little bit bolshy, and I, post-school, I wanted to, I don't know, start setting my stall out and start making my own decisions. And he said, I don't mind what you do, but I don't want you to go to Stellenbosch University because it's a very Afrikaans university, and you know how I feel about that kind of thing. So I got a scholarship to Stellenbosch University. So I went to Stellenbosch University, as you do. I'm looking forward to my 12-year-old son making the same stupid decisions. But it wasn't for me. It was a great decision because there were some incredible people there. But we went through that literally in the middle of that, you know. So, you know, South Africa being left out of world sport and making those decisions, and the racism and the bigotry and all the stuff that had happened politically infusing itself into sport actually affected me, you know, completely. I mean, I wouldn't have been proud to even play for South Africa, but that was uninformed because South Africa didn't play against anyone. Mm-hmm. In apartheid, it wasn't rugby wasn't a vocation. You couldn't play rugby for a living. Mm-hmm. You know, so I went to Stellenbosch to study human movement sciences. I wanted to get into something active and outdoors and then go and explore the world. And I, you know, rugby sort of crept up on me. It became a vocation. You know, by 96, I was the first contracted professional rugby player in the whole of South Africa. I was the captain of South Africa under 19, and they signed me up 3 days before the World Cup final. And they said, you know, we're going to hedge our bets a bit here because we might lose a couple of the senior players. Francois Pienaar and the guys are all negotiating with Murdoch, and, you know, there's a lot going on behind the scenes, and they signed up the younger players. And for me, it suddenly became a way to pay for my studies, a way for me to then, you know, carry it on. But it became a way that I could then, I mean, I wrote letters, you know, from Leinster to London Irish to clubs over here, rugby league clubs in Australia, exploring options, because suddenly the world went from no option except to maybe play a few Currie Cup games, which is our domestic competition, mm-hmm. you know, like the pro competition over here, to suddenly this could be a passport internationally. And I embraced that because I think rugby has become that these days. And to be honest, I'd be a little bit jealous of 18 or 19-year-old kids now because rugby isn't another form of passport. But they can travel around the world.
You were the poster boy of South African rugby when you burst onto the scene. So I'm just intrigued as to understand what the environment of the South African setup is like post that moment in 95. versus now what you see, where there seems like this incredible togetherness within the Springboks, where there isn't a them and us environment. And rather, I don't want to labour the point, but it must have been a huge progression from that moment in 95 to where we are just a little over 20 years later.
Yeah, look, I think so. And you make, you know, it's a very kind way to say it and not to labour the point, but it was difficult. You know, I spoke English, first language. I came from a very English background, but I'd spoken Afrikaans second language. I'm fluent in Afrikaans, so I can read and write and converse and work in the language. But it wasn't my language of choice, and I lived in an environment where an Afrikaans government had given us an environment that I didn't agree with. You know, my surname is Skinstad. It's a Scandinavian origin. I think I got to my second year in Stellenbosch before they realized it wasn't Afrikaans. Maybe that's why I got picked. But in fact, I remember a story. So I went in at the end of my first year. I was picked as the captain, and good example. The coach obviously didn't know that Skinstad wasn't Skinstad. It came from Schonstad, which is a small town on the coast of Norway. Literally, I don't know, 150 odd years ago, my dad's grandparents moved to South Africa, and we went into the change room, and I was the only guy in the change room who spoke English as a first language. And you have quite a traditional environment in South Africa. You know, I'm not particularly religious myself, and I've got no qualms with anyone who is, but rugby is a full contact sport, and all the Afrikaans schools growing up, they pray. You take a knee and you pray before the game. Now, whether you're religious or not, you know, let's just say you're a hedge betting man, it's not a bad option to, you know, just to say a few words before this full contact sport. And we've seen how dangerous it can be. So we get this circle of people together, and the coach looks at me, and here's your first lesson in Afrikaans. The coach looks at me and he says, "Kom ons bid." So I look at him and I go, I know this bit. Well, I obviously don't say it, but, you know, mentally I'm going, okay, because, I mean, I only started shaving probably last week, as Woody would tell you. At this stage, I've met all these guys. I'm 19. Everybody looks like a Neanderthal. I look around and I realize I know what he needs from me. He needs a bit of leadership. He needs a... So I sort of give myself a slightly more gruff voice, and I shout a little bit, and I walk across the group, and I played with guys like Kobus Fasachi, who played for Saracens for years, and I slapped him in the face. And I stamped my foot a little bit, and I sort of shook. You know, the stuff you guys are good at in the front row there. I try to avoid it for all the years, and I sort of made my case a little bit, and then I went back to my position. I looked at the coach. And you could see he was veritably pleased about the situation unfolding. But then he said to me again, he said the same word. He said, "Kom ons bid." And I thought, I can't believe I haven't done enough here. But I'm going to take some prisoners. And I went out, and there were a couple of outside backs. Brayton Paulser was playing in our team in the under-19. He moved out of the circle. He wouldn't let me come close to him because I was slapping and kicking. I was doing... And I went in almost for a headbutt on one of the guys. I thought, we don't want to take him down, but I was growling as low as I could. It was still a squeaky voice, actually. And I went back to my spot, and I was next to a guy called Wayne Munn. And Wayne came over and played rugby here for Connaught, played scrum off and wing for Connaught for a couple of years. And Wayne was a particularly talented player, schoolboy level, played SA under 21 with me, but he was with me at Stellenbosch. And his mum was Afrikaans, and his dad was English. So at that stage, he could speak more Afrikaans than me. And he whispered under his breath the real meaning of Kom ons bid, which was, "Let us pray." And and I stopped sweating, and I said the first prayer which came to mind. I said, "For what we're about to receive, may the Lord make us strong." And it won't surprise you that I've never been asked back to Stellenbosch University to do any form of motivational speaking or anything like that. But to be honest, it was a hotbed of a lot of you know, sometimes at that stage I felt we only opened our mouth to change feet. You don't really know who you're pissing off, who you're not, you know, whether you're making the right things or not. But
Michael, you might talk to us about April 18th, 2012, which was, I think, a day that changed your life forever.
Me, sorry.
Yeah, oh, yeah, sorry, yes.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, those that don't know, in 2012 I had a stroke, quite a major one in Brisbane. So, yeah, it was a bit of a change for me, so to say. What would you like to know?
Well, I was reading your autobiography, which is well worth a read. And
thank you.
Funny, you mentioned Andre Agassi's autobiography quite early in it, and like the opening chapter of that is seen as probably one of the great opening chapters of any sports autobiography. Mm. When just the reveal of post-match, the pain, and you talk a lot very early in the book, and you paint a pretty bleak picture of the days after you have that stroke, and the pain is so severe that you're very much questioning what's next, and you come to the right decision. But like those initial days afterwards, just how tough was it, and the journey to where you are now?
Yeah, it was pretty hard. I mean, how to make this a little bit more entertaining than what it really is. I had my back right artery here split in Brisbane, and that caused the stroke to happen. So it was a big bleed and swelling on the brain. And I was jet lagged. I'd only gone to Brisbane for about 3 days to visit my parents. And I ended up staying 2.5 months. And I was with some friends on the evening, and I took a sip of beer, went down the wrong way, and coughing and choking fit, which we've all done. It was quite a big one, but then for various reasons my artery split and went to hospital. It's actually it was on a Monday evening about 6:30. Nobody else in the place. We'd eaten and I'd only had a couple of light beers. It wasn't a big night at all. And then I remember this happening, and friends had called an ambulance, and I was sort of lying down, and the ambulance people have arrived. And I remember this young lady who was serving us that night came over and started, you know, oh my God, you know, squealed, and what's going on here, and oh geez, you know. And anyway, one of my friends said, don't worry, love, we think it was the steak. And I started to laugh, and they said, don't laugh. Anyway, I went to the hospital and in intensive care, and nice friends, huh? then the first word was, well, when I first heard the word stroke, I thought it was sort of, you know, jet-lagged, a bit dehydrated, tired, that sort of thing. They'd give me a tablet and send me home and say, sleep it off, but stroke. And then it was, you know, brain operation, brain surgery. I thought, shit, this is pretty important, this is pretty serious. And then I sort of got around all that and sort of, okay, I'm ready to go. And I'll never forget, the two doctors came and sat at the end of the bed and said, we're not going to do it. And I said, why not? I'm ready to go. And I was sort of conscious through all this, and while I couldn't see, I sort of knew what was going on. I'd lost all my sight, and was quite in a lot of pain and what have you. So, but then they said, well, you're functioning too well for what's happened to you, and we don't want to go in and, you know, things go wrong when you have brain surgery. And so we don't want to do that. We're going to do it a different way, and which involved over the next 2 or 3 days of basically trying to reduce the swelling by dehydration. And unbeknownst to me, my father was there, and he's a clinical psychologist, so it had been used to dealing with brain injuries and things like that, so he sort of knew a little bit about what was going on. And unbeknownst to me, he asked the doctors when I wasn't in the room, you know, how often does this work? And he said, we've never done it before. So that was a bit worrying. But over those 3 days, and the doctors always said that it'd take 3 to 4 days before we knew it was working or not. And in the meantime, they'd wake me every half an hour and ask me all these questions to see if my condition was worsening. And if it did, they'd take me in to operate. And they'd ask me questions like, who is the Australian Prime Minister? And I sort of went, well, when I came in, it was. It could have changed by now. But and then gradually, after about 3 days, it was getting pretty bad. And the pain and just everything. And, in the book it was, I remember it was late at night, sort of early morning, and it was just, you know, I'm thinking, oh, my wife's okay, she's young, you know, so she'll be all right and all that sort of thing. And then I got three boys and started thinking about them and, you know, what would happen and stuff. And I said, no. In my own mind, I sort of, no, I want to go and see them again. And this is God on its truth. It's not sort of something I've made up and just to sell books. It hasn't sold very well anyway, but and I just sort of made my mind up at that moment, you know, no, I'm going to fight this and try and go home and see my kids. Bear in mind, my kids and wife are in London. I'm in Brisbane, the other side of the world. So, and it was quite... I'm not saying that I've got this huge mental power, but that sort of decision to fight and then coincide that with the doctors and what they were doing started to work at the same time. And after, you know, the next day, I remember my father coming in, and he says in the book, I think, where he basically said something had changed. Michael seemed to be better than he was the day before. The previous 3 days, he was worse. And then I came out of that and went upstairs to the ward and just sort of tended to recover. And I still have after effects. I only have half my sight. I've only got... I wear these because I'm old and I can't read and see, but my sight, I lost all my peripheral vision to the left. So if I look over here, I can't see anything over here. I can't see my hand here or anything like that. Looking at you lot, it's not a bad thing, but anyway. sorry. And I didn't drive for three and a half years, but now I do. So if you see me on the road, stay out of my way. But apart from that, it was a big thing, and I get asked a lot, did it change you? Do you live every day as like it's your last now? And I said, well, and that's often people say yes, but I sort of knew I'd had a pretty good life before that, you know, good family, good kids, and job, and played for my country, all that sort of thing. So I knew I had a pretty good life before that, so I didn't need to have a stroke to reaffirm that. But so I'm grateful, and it was hard, but I'm sort of 6 years out now, and everything's good, touch wood.
Brilliant. Bobby, you touched on it there, your Irish heritage. County Louth, what is the link? Your mother's from Louth, was born in Louth?
Yeah, my mum was born in Collingford, yeah. Her family came from this part of the world. Her mum and dad, my grandparents, moved to the UK and then did some work in India, and then from, I think, tea plantation to sugarcane plantation in Southern Africa. And then my mum and dad met when she was working in a town called Bulawayo, and my dad was studying medicine over there.
So what were you doing wasting your time winning World Cups with the Springboks when you could have been suffering proper pain with Ireland? Proper pain. Was it ever an option?
Well, it was when I was a youngster. I got a, like I said, I wrote a few letters. There'd be a couple of guys who... kicking themselves they didn't answer, but I think the guys who were aware those days, I mean, it was pretty rare those days to, you know, even dual passport, you know, was an event that happened because somebody found out or someone knew their cousin that actually there was access. I still remember there were a couple of World Cups where after the time the mum said, no, I was only joking, it wasn't your uncle from Wales, it was just an uncle from New Zealand. Yeah. I would have really enjoyed playing rugby over here. But I came to the UK, you know, too late. I'd played Super Rugby and Currie Cup Rugby. And I came over... In fact, I came over post-2003 World Cup, which I'd made the squad and then broken my arm in a warm-up game. And I came over because there was an agent who wanted to make a nice big commission. And I went to a team called the Newport Gwent Dragons.
Ooh. Yeah. Nice part of the world.
Yeah. Rodney Parade. Nice yeah. part of the world. And and for about 5.5 weeks, I was the highest paid rugby player in the world, which was nice.
Oh yeah. What are we talking?
Not very much. But in rands, it was gazillions. But in pounds, it was a couple of quid. But I I then had a meeting with the owner, Tony Brown. What a lovely man.
A very good guy. Actually,
really a lovely man. And he didn't give a shit. He was delighted that I was there. And I'd said, I need to have a meeting with you. And I had a meeting and I'd written him a letter. And I explained exactly why, although I'd come over as this highly paid professional, I'd decided not to play rugby anymore. And that sort of clashed with his plans for me in the club. and I think we needed to speak. And he read my letter, and he brought the letter to. We had a meeting at breakfast. I didn't tell him that I'd when he said I'll meet you at it was there's a Celtic is a Celtic Manor. Yeah. He said I'll see you at 7 o'clock at Celtic Manor. So I turned up for breakfast. And had to wait 12 hours until he turned up for dinner. It was much nicer to have dinner there. Anyway, I got to go home, but I think I was just a bit nervous. Anyway, he read the letter, and we chatted. He said, absolutely no problem. I'll sign you off. He said, I love the letter, and if you're not into it, you shoot. Good luck. Hope it goes well.
I had the same conversation
with
Tony Brown.
Oh, really? Yeah. What a lovely man.
Really, really nice guy. And,
nobody just wanted to play for him.
No, it was Gary Teichman.
He was the heir to the
beforehand.
Yeah, that's right.
And we met him in Dirty Nelly's down in Bunratty. He flew over, and my wife happened to be flying in later on, and the taxi dropped her inside. She came into the end of the conversation, and it was actually a crazy amount of money. And it would come in, take over as captain, then take over as maybe CEO of the club. That was kind of part of it, was to build this big thing with the club.
I didn't have those clauses in mind.
it was a mad conversation. And we never mentioned who it was. So my wife was listening to all this conversation. And so we got into the car, and she said, who is it? I said, Newport. We're not going. So the conversation finished as soon as we got back
quickly,
into the car.
Yeah.
That was the end of that, so that never happened. He was a really, really nice man.
A really good... But he was the heir to the Bisley furniture empire. He'd made squadrillions of money. His kids and him didn't get on. And this was his sort of... I don't know, his...
Could have adopted you.
Well... That was a clause I would have put in.
I never got to play, or I never got to talk to him, obviously, because I never would have played against the Newport Gwent Dragons throughout the Pro 14. There was a T-shirt I remember seeing on TV.
You missed out, eh?
I mean,
you might have missed out on the day when the Newport Gwent Dragons turned over Leinster at the Leinster Stadium.
Really?
And I was pissed in the stands because I'd already retired.
Well, you because Percy went and played. Percy Montgomery went and played for like four or five
together.
Seasons.
Yep.
So
he was there.
What? How? You leave Cape Town and go to Newport? Like
Percy had different reasons.
Percy really likes money.
Wow. No, that's unfair. I mean, I think Percy's got a healthy respect for money. but I think Percy came to Newport to find himself, really.
Okay.
Because himself had left Cape Town at that stage.
Oh, right, okay.
And did he?
Well, he did. He went back and played for South Africa after that. In fact, he taught himself to kick for poles. I mean, Percy was not a guy who was known for his goal kicking before that. And, turns out in Newport, there's not a hell of a lot to do. So he got really good at goal kicking, and that worked out for him.
It most certainly did work out for him. And you mentioned your sabbatical there. I was reading an interview, I think you did, in 2006, where you're in the middle of your sabbatical and you're asked about professional rugby, and you're like, I could go back, but I just don't really have any interest. And then a year later, you're winning a World Cup with South Africa. How do you look back at that World Cup where you were a replacement in the semi-final, you didn't make the match day squad? Like, is it something you look back and go, that was one of the best decisions I ever made going back in for that World Cup?
Look, I think I was incredibly rugby, incredibly lucky even to play rugby professionally, because it's a great thing to do. I mean, look, it's quite boring between Saturday afternoon at 5 o'clock and Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock, the in-between bit, but the games are amazing, and where you go and who you meet and the time you spend. I mean, the time when I said I don't think I'd go back to professional rugby, I was playing for the Barbarians. I credit Brian with keeping me interested because I was having the time of my life. I mean, they were in the best nick. Mel, Shane, Brian were in an island side which was all conquering. The guys had done incredibly well on Lions tours. We brought in different players from around the world, and it just turned out that they needed a sort of slightly slow, older, unfit, loose forward who was always available. So I toured Georgia, South America, North America, Spain. It was the best time of my life. I didn't want to go back to professional at all, in fact.
But you did.
I did. And then I was really lucky. In fact, the only reason I went back to professional rugby was I wanted to go back to South Africa. And I'm a big believer in getting your mind right and stuff. I don't have an amazing story like Michael's story, but I believe in decisions and moments that change what you do. And I genuinely got a call after playing some Barbells rugby with these guys, and I played a bit at Richmond and that kind of thing. And I was getting back into sort of being in love with the game, because you've got to love rugby. I mean, there's a lot that rugby gives you and team-wise and friend-wise, which you could get from another game, you know. But the camaraderie and the loyalty and that kind of thing, it goes on for eons, you know. So I think the beauty about it was that I'd fallen back in love with the concept of rugby, and then I got a call from one of the Super Rugby franchises, and I thought to myself, my wife was preggy, I wanted to have kiddies in South Africa, and she just said, I don't really care what the decision is, as long as you stop pacing up and down the corridor and make a decision, because I'm pregnant and I want to go to sleep.
Is preggy the official term in South Africa?
is preggy not a thing? Is preggy not even a thing? That's terrible. Okay, my wife was
first
pregnant.
Time.
Okay.
Were you a teenager? Were you?
I was a teenager, exactly. And well, now I'm gone. Huh? I've got no chance now. Anyway, I was lucky enough, and what happened was I got a call from John Smith, and I went back and played at the Sharks, and they had a really good side. And I did. I played on the bench for that side. There were a couple of the loose forwards who got some injuries halfway through, and they ended up playing that season. We played in the Super Rugby final, lost to the Bulls, and then I was involved and included in the South African team. But it had happened for me in London. I'd said to my wife, if we're going to go back to South Africa, I need to go for a reason. And you know, this team had serious potential. And I said, well, let's find a way to go back to try and compete for a Rugby World Cup. And that became, you know, the story, the mantra for me for 18 months. And we went all the way through. I was lucky enough to be part of that team and go to 2007.
Are you okay with not playing in the final?
I am, actually. I mean, I knew I wasn't going to play in the final on the Tuesday. Well, in fact, I knew I wasn't going to play in the final when France lost to England. You know, and we'd pre-prepped. You know, you get different kinds of players. I was a forward who I've avoided rucks and tackles and any of the.
So you're back.
Yeah, the back. But we had, as South Africa, a lot of you guys know, we've got backs who love the forward stuff, so it was perfect. So I just swapped out and went and did that stuff. And, you know, that was something that was of value for our team against an Argentina or a France or all of our pool games. But in a really tight game and a game where they were going to expect someone to go and steal a ball at a ruck or try and do something that was sort of flanky.
Flanky
and flanky.
And we had I trained with a guy called Vickers van Heerden, and I knew that if we were playing England, I wasn't going to play. So on Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock, 8:15-ish, I mean, I don't really remember the paneled walls of the hotel, long corridor, Jake White, and I was trying to avoid him, but there was a passage, so it was hard. And he said to me, Bob, you know, we spoke last week and you're going to be outside of the 23. So I went back to my room and cried my eyes out.
Did you actually cry?
I did. But I got a phone call from my father-in-law at about 9:30. And my son, Tom, had been born a week early.
There you go.
You know, so I said, well, that's nothing, I've been dropped and whatever. I'm teasing.
We are going to build up to the weekend in just a little while. We have some very special guests we want to bring you as well, so stay in your seats. We will take a break in around 20, 25 minutes, so there'll be plenty of time to get a drink. But we're going to get our special guests on. But first, will you give it up, please, for Michael Leiner, for Bobby Skinstead, and for Keith Wood.
I'm
We are here tonight with thanks to Heineken, official worldwide partner of Rugby World Cup Japan 2019. Please, you can take a step to the side of stage, lads, because our next guest is ready to go. Please give it up for the man who wrote, well, some would say it was initially Brian O'Driscoll's autobiography, inspired by, potentially, we will soon find out. He is the man behind the Ross O'Carroll Kelly series. Please give it up for Paul Howard.
Oh, great. This is my second time here this week, actually. I was here on Sunday night at Christa Berg. And I was sitting right at the back, and all I could see in the first sort of six or seven rows at the end when he played Patricia the Stripper, he sang Patricia the Stripper, was people taking off their underwear and throwing on the stage. So this is... I admire your restraint, actually.
So is it just pure coincidence that Ross O'Carroll Kelly came on the scene as the exact same time as Brian O'Driscoll came on the scene?
Say yes. Say yes.
Well, yes. I mean, it is really. I mean, I had been covering schools rugby for years and years. And I covered this match once, and I heard a kid from a school. I won't say the school's name. It wouldn't be fair. Blackrock College. And... I heard him say to his dad, "I don't give a fuck how you think I played. Just crack open the wallet."
Does that sound familiar?
Sometimes I tell people that it was Brian, you know, just for fun. But I'm sure it wasn't. But when I started writing Ross O'Carroll Kelly, all these stories were in my head from covering the games. And it was just all there on instant recall. It was a kind of lifetime of it.
So when you sit down for the first time, you go, right, I'm gonna put something together. Have you a very clear picture as to where it's going to go? Or did that just evolve? Or did the pages end up writing themselves?
I live with an
author, right. And I'm flabbergasted at how... You have a blank page, and all of a sudden, it's a brain dump.
And Amy has the discipline to actually sit there and look at the blank page and wait for inspiration to strike. I suppose, I mean, like I said, I'd covered so much schools rugby. I didn't understand schools rugby. I didn't understand rugby when I started writing about it. And I was sent by the Irish Independent, when I was about 17 or 18 to cover a match in Skerries. And I remember reading a book called The Laws of Rugby on the bus to Skerries. The bus to Skerries used to take about 5 hours in those days. And it was the only bus I ever saw with a duty-free trolley service on it. Anyway, I sort of went out there, and I was kind of blown away by the sort of pageantry, by the colour of schools rugby. I went to a football school. We were very good at football. I didn't really know anything about rugby, which is why I was reading The Laws of Rugby. But, you know, if 20 people stayed behind to watch a match, you were lucky. And these schools' matches, there'd be like thousands of people who've left school, you know, 30 years earlier, but they're still aligned to their school, you know. And seeing all these, you know, these mothers... like in seal fur, like standing with like, like I've never saw women in seal fur watching sport before in Skerries, like, you know, and dads on the early mobile phones, like in 1996 when no one had a mobile phone, shouting, doing business on the sideline, and then these gangs of girls just throwing themselves at these horrifically ugly rugby players in a lot of cases, like, you know, press and company accept it, Brian, you know. And I just
God, the
thought,
old rugby's great, huh?
And I just thought it's ripe for sending up. But when I started writing the column in the Sunday Tribune, and for the first 2 or 3 years, finally getting to your question, I didn't put my name on it. So it was just the diary of a school's rugby player by Ross O'Carroll Kelly. And no one knew it was me for about 3 years, but everybody was guessing who it might be. I told some people it was Ryle Nugent once for fun. And somebody attacked him in a pub once, and I happened to be with him at the time. And this guy said to Ryle, he got him up against the wall, I just slammed him up and said, some of us have to live in Tala. And I had written something about Tala the week before. I'd written something. The joke was Ross had his mobile phone stolen and he was going out to Tala to get it back. And he falls asleep, in the car, and he looks out the window and he goes, Jesus, look at this place. The horror, the deprivation. How do people live like this? And his friend says, Ross, we're still in Terra Nure. Right? So that's the joke. The joke is Terra Nure. This guy thought the joke was Tala, and he gets Ryle up against the wall. Some of us have to live in Tala. Ryle hadn't a clue what he was talking about. But I did. So being a good friend, I just started moonwalking out of the pub and I left, you know. But anyway, so nobody knew I was writing it. But then Ross left Castle Rock College and went to UCD, and he did a sports management course in UCD. And one of his classmates, I didn't know it at the time, was Brian O'Driscoll. And I had never heard of Brian O'Driscoll. It was around 1998,
yeah,
around that time. So people used to ring the Tribune and they'd say, you have to tell me, I'm in UCD, you have to tell me who's writing that column. Is it Draco? and Draco, it turned out, was you. Or Scales, Kieran Scally was a suspect for a while. So I used to just say yes, you know. So if there is a crossover between Brian and Ross, it's because I did encourage that view.
I was guilty earlier on, foolishly, of underestimating the amount of Munster supporters were here. But just so we know what type of audience we have, how many people here played Schools Cup rugby? They were a bit slow to put their hands up there.
There's always about 5 times more people claim to play Schools Cup rugby than actually did play Schools Cup rugby. How many people here have a Leinster School Senior Cup medal?
How aware of you were this? Were you of this then around 98, 99?
Yeah, a bit, but it's...
Delighted with it?
I wouldn't say delighted. I'm also, you know, I speak like this now, but I'm from the north side. I'm not meant to speak like this. And I hear it in my kids now. It's like, you're definitely not meant to speak like that, you know? So I was always kind of fighting that, and I thought, it can't be based on me because Ross is, you know, proper south side.
Yeah.
So I was like, no, it's not. But it really, I suppose in those early days, it was a bit of fun, but then it's evolved into this absolute beast over 20 years.
Yeah.
So what we see now, you know, you look back retrospectively, it was a fraction of where it's at now. And there's not many people in Ireland don't know Ross O'Carroll Kelly. You know, whether it's your thing to read or not, but you know, some of the lines, I don't care who you are absolutely brilliant.
Thank you.
So I enjoyed reading. I read some of the early books, and I'm in the middle of Schmidt Happens, and enjoying it.
Brian features in just about every book as well, like in some form.
Mr. Royalties,
like, you know. I want to nip that one in the bud now. And just say no.
Was it something that was talked about in the Leinster dressing room, pointing of fingers?
Not really. No, it was. I think if someone
who
was getting the piss
most
taken
like
out of them,
Ross O'Carroll Kelly.
Who was what?
Who was the most like Ross O'Carroll Kelly in that Leinster dressing room? You're amongst friends here. It's off record. Put off that phone.
Ian Madigan and Luke would be both strong contenders. I'm. Do you know what? I'm really looking forward to hearing about Jamie Heaslip's podcast in the next edition as well. Oh.
I mean, there's definitely a bit of Ross in Jamie, you know.
Which bit?
Well, I'm Jamie. Like Jamie's amazing because, like, you know, they say, you know, they try to kind of combat this notion that rugby is a South Dublin thing, and they say, you know, Jamie Heaslip's from Kildare, and then you hear Jamie Heaslip speak. That ain't no Kildare accent, you know.
The latest book, number.
It's number 19 in the trilogy. Wow. Yeah, it's called Nobody Shouted Stop.
Schmidt happens.
Yeah.
Did you send it to Joe Schmidt?
Well, people keep asking. I did send him a copy, but people keep asking, "Did you ask his permission?" And my view on that has always been, it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission, because there's a chance they might say no. So. About 6 or 7 years ago, I wrote a book called Triggs, The Autobiography of Roy Keane's Dog. And I had the same questions then, did you ask for Roy Keane's permission? And, you know, it was I didn't, but that was mostly out of fear of what he might do to me.
I don't know why.
It's a little bit like going in and showing your next-door neighbours your plans for your extension of your house. Sometimes you're better off just going ahead and doing it.
And they're looking out the back saying, what is Brian doing next door? So I decided to call it Schmidt Happens, and I was doing an interview, a charity thing for Purple House in Bray, and I was interviewing Joe and Andy Farrell and Simon Easterby and Richie Murphy in the Burlington, and we decided on the title of the book, and I said, let's just keep the title quiet until after I meet Joe Schmidt on Thursday week. But I made the mistake of telling Richie Murphy what the title of the book was, and he said, oh, you want to keep that quiet, like Joe won't be happy with that at all. He said, but trust me, I won't say a word. So Richie, as soon as I left, I was meeting Richie in the Burlington a couple of weeks before, and as soon as I left, Richie rang Joe Schmidt and said, you know, the next book is called Schmidt Happens. So anyway, I went in on the night of the gig thinking Joe didn't know anything about this, and I asked the first question. I was in your role that night. I asked the first question, and Simon Easterby cut across me and said, well, let me ask you a question. What do you mean writing a book with a title that takes the piss out of the national coach? And Joe was just glowering at me. Anyway, it was about 10 seconds of uncomfortable silence before Joe laughed. And then that was it.
Jamie Heaslip's autobiography, a bestseller, I presume. It's very much out there right now. It's sort of overshadowing Gordon Darcy's autobiography, which you wrote, is just out this week. Now, it's a kid's book.
Yes.
Why is that? Or does this make total sense?
There's something about Gordon's career that was that's sort of perfect for telling as a kid's story. There's a moral at the end of it, and it's kind of the story of a young man who gets it all very early, gets it all too soon, and loses the run of himself a little bit, and then is kind of pushed to the sidelines and realizes he has to go away and invent himself all over again. And when Gordon rang me and said, I want to do a book, my first reaction was, how am I going to get out of this? Like, you know, because, you know, as a former sports journalist who's written, you know, 19 books about rugby, people think I actually know something about rugby. So I do get asked from time to time to do to ghostwrite, and I didn't want to do it. And then when he said I want to do it as a kid's book, I thought, wow, what a great idea. And it's different. I don't think anyone's done it before. Like I don't think any Irish sports person has ever told their story as a kid's book with a moral at the end that, you know, 8 to 12 year old kids can read and get something from.
Is the moral of the story, screw that other guy who takes all the glory? Does he feature?
Yeah, I was telling Brian beforehand, Gordon's heroics actually overshadow Brian's a lot of the time. You know?
Right.
And there's some tries Brian's scored in his career that are like strikingly similar to ones we've described Gordon scoring in the book. So taking some of your heroics, I hope you don't mind.
And it's one of... Hopefully
yeah, I mean, this is the first.
Will there be
the
more
first.
Than one?
I mean, we're planning to do three altogether.
Okay. 19, so.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, I always start off planning to do three and then don't know where to stop. I'll be up here at 65 years of age still writing them.
We are here tonight with thanks to Heineken, official worldwide partner of Rugby World Cup Japan 2019. Coming up a little bit later, don't forget we have our crappy quiz, where one of you in the audience is going to be given a chance of winning a pair of tickets to the 2020 Heineken Champions Cup in Marseille, with flights and accommodation included. Remember, to be in with a chance of winning, just tweet a selfie of yourself in the crowd, the hashtag OTBBGET. Paul, it's been brilliant to have you with us.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much for joining
thanks
us on stage.
Right.
Stick
thanks
with us. We got a little video for you here.
Hey guys, Danny from the Coronas here. We are here in Onsullis in Tokyo for the Rugby World Cup. I've been flown over by Heineken, and it looks like I'm going to be doing a couple of songs. Fingers crossed it'll go down well, but delighted to be in Tokyo. Very excited about the rugby, and fingers crossed Ireland are going to go all the way.
This is our baby.
So much fun. Impromptu gig in Tokyo. Who'd have thought it?
This is our baby.
Yeah, we're loving the experience. It's great to be here. The Irish tend to travel everywhere, but like, it's funny, even since we came here, like, the amount of Irish we've seen, they just travel more than any of the supporters, I think. They just go everywhere. Good team. Technically, we're number one in the world, which is pretty impressive. You never know if we get to a quarter final, who knows?
Sing it together. It's beginning to happen, and it's beginning to move.
All right, give it up, please, for Danny O'Reilly.
Up in the middle there.
Don't mention the word junkus. That looked good.
That was so much fun. So much fun. I'm very happy to be here. Surprise for a couple of reasons. The first, last time I was on off the ball, I called J.R. Gilroy Nathan, and that didn't go down well. Oof. And then I mentioned a competitor, another podcast that we're not allowed to mention.
Get off.
And so I thought I'd never be asked again. And then also somehow, because I just also, the height of my rugby knowledge is second year and third year, who Paul liked to slag, I made the bees. And but anyway, here, I'm here now.
You have a strong rugby link, though. You played at Brian O'Driscoll's wedding.
Absolutely, yeah, and that makes me know all sorts about rugby.
Smashed it, absolutely smashed it.
Nailed it.
It was so much fun. And it was funny because we, like, Bod asked us to play. We're like, of course we will, absolutely. And we met Amy way back, like, when she started out, and we were on a TV show way back. And anyway, so we were like, okay, we played the wedding, amazing. So we sent a message to Brian and Amy going, so what songs do you want us to play? Like, thinking that they'd have a list of certain covers, you know, maybe a bit of Stevie Wonder, whatever, the wedding songs, like. And they just started listing all Corona songs that they loved. I was like, oh, they actually know our songs. That was cool. So, that was it was a great guy. But also, I would say, we were there at the day two, like, and so we played the gig. It was great. And after, we were at the bar having a few pints, and, like, Brian came up, and, like, must have been chatting away to us for about an hour at the bar, just the four of us. And I was like, Brian, like, after a while, like, Brian, this is your wedding. Like, go on. He goes, I've fucking seen enough of them. It's grand. It's grand.
I remember, because we had another band before, there were a cover band called the Bogus Brothers. And then the big thing was for everyone to have a great time. And I wanted to make sure the boys had a good time as well. I remember the lead singer of that going out to Danny. They came back on after the Coronas had played and came out to Danny out in the audience, and we're all dancing away, and, you know, Amy and I are up on chairs, and anyway, he puts a microphone in front of Danny, and I think might have been Journey, Don't Stop Believing, and he belted out about two lines of it, and I've never seen another singer's face drop. It was like, Jesus, I sound shit now after your man. He was like, enough of you. It was insane. Yeah. Like, it's a different level voice this guy has.
Yeah, very good.
So how was Japan?
Was
what were we over for? The Scotland game?
Scotland game, yeah. So it was great. We were there for 6 days. It was amazing. But like, it was a real last-minute thing. I actually bumped into you in Rat Minds only like a month ago, and I was saying, I think we're going to be going over for the first game, or a month before the first game. And it was so much fun. It was deadly. It was just an amazing few days. Like, We, Scotland game was brilliant. We had the best seats in the house. It was and a great. Everything was organised really well, and we had, a bit of crack as you can see there. I actually haven't seen that video yet. It was real sort of last minute mess.
Had you been to Japan before?
Once, we toured there way back once, just briefly for a couple of days. We were in Tokyo, but this was the first time I had a few days off. Like so, it was great. We had a great time.
And did Josh Smith invite you into the captain's run?
Yeah. We went in on the actually Vinny Hammond, who you know is a friend of ours from back in the day, and he's the video analysis guy for the team. So he texted us and said, "Come down." So we went down the Friday to the captain's run and met the lads and all, chatting away. And it was cool to see the stadium in Yokohama empty under lights and the boys training away. And then all the press were kicked off, but we were allowed to stay and watch the second half of the training session and all. And that's when Rob Kearney and the lads who were injured actually went off and were admitted that they were injured as opposed to jogging through the warm-up pretending they're all right when the cameras are there.
But that hardly ever happens under Joe Schmidt.
The warm-up was so light until they kicked away the cameras and then the three boys went off the back and started stretching while the real training happened. But it was great. And then on the Sunday after, Joe had asked me to go in and sing a few songs for the team when they were in camp in the summer. So I went in and brought a few musician friends of mine and we sang a few songs. So he rang me up out of the blue and I was like, no way, this isn't Joe Smith, this is Mario Rosenstock or something taking the piss out of me.
Joe Smith himself organises the entertainment.
Yeah, he just rang me, honestly, yeah.
And is he a fan?
I don't think so, no, he was like... yeah.
He is now.
Yeah. So he asked me and he was really sound. We went in and sang a few songs. So anyway, I had his number, right? So after the Scotland game, bear in mind, we've been on the piss all day. Great day. Really good fun. And it gets to 3 in the morning, I'm going home, and I thought it was a brilliant idea. This is my moment now. I'll text Joe.
Sorry, what?
I drunk texted Joe Smith at 3 in the morning after the Scotland game. And it wasn't even so much the message, it was just when you wake up the next day and you see the time, it's 3:04 a.m.
Did you look to the end of the message and see if there was an X at the bottom?
The two blue ticks had come up, but
what did you say?
I can read it out for you if you want.
Yes,
okay,
this is very Michael McIntyre. Show us your messages.
Joe's a detail guy, so is everything spelt well?
Yeah, I spent ages concocting this, right? All it said, I was just feeling very philosophical. It just said, tus ma latna hibra, right? That was it. I thought, that means good starts half the battle, lads. Come on.
Right.
Okay, did you know that? You've never heard that saying?
No.
Okay, it means good starts half the battle. And for some reason, I thought Joe Smith would understand my Irish.
Ah, yeah.
Thought that was a great idea, but obviously
he's into his Irish culture, but I don't think he's quite gone that far.
I thought, he'll ask someone what that means, and then he'll go, that Danny is real fucking smart guy. Fair play to him, he responded right the next day, and he obviously just threw it into Google Translate or something, because he's like, "Ha, thanks, Danny. Yeah, the first half was good, actually." I left him hanging. I didn't respond to that. So,
that was the end of the text conversation. You did very much party out there, as you would as a rock star, as you could be a rock star from Terranure. You were up late some night. You went to a karaoke bar.
We did.
The cameras were out.
Oh, yeah.
Bod the blonde years that you really love.
The picture of Bod with the blonde hair makes that. That song doesn't work unless you have Bod with the blonde hair. But actually, it was funny, that came, me and my mates used to sing that to each other. What if Bod was one of us? And eventually, one time, when we were supporting the script in the Aviva, and one of my mates, Macker, was there, and we met Bod after, and I was like, I'll introduce you, like, and mark out a few points on him. And his aim was to sing this to Bod. What if Bod was one of us? That's what he thought would be good. He goes, wait, Bod gets a load of this. But in his drunken state, he got mixed up and he said, he is Bod. He is Bod. And I was like, that's not even the right song. But actually, after I saw you in Rap Minds, well, I heard you slagging Jamie Heaster backstage, so I have to defend him. But so I follow Bod on Instagram, right? So, and he puts up these stories now and again where he's just chatting to the camera and he's telling them what's going on, giving his insight into the
connecting with his people.
Yeah, exactly.
Content.
So it was one Saturday, yeah.
Content.
One Saturday, or it was only a few weeks ago anyway, I clicked on, and of course Bod hadn't put on the sound, right? So he was talking into the camera with no sound, right? But you also didn't have the comments on. So all the comments were coming up going, Brian, there's no sound. Oh no, Bod. Oh God. Oh, this is terrible. Someone ring him. It was going on for ages, and you were just chatting into the...
I didn't realise, yeah, it was connected to a Bluetooth speaker on the TV, and I was just chatting away. It must have been... 90 seconds chatting away. I was
easy.
Like, I'll get to the comments in a minute.
And eventually, but the best comment of them all was, I'd still rather watch this than listen to Jamie Heaster's podcast.
Oh. You know, this would be great crack if Jamie Heaslip wasn't on Off the Ball tomorrow night. Talking about his ball. And I am most definitely taking tomorrow off because it's going to be bloody awkward. So you're coming back at the end of the show to sing a live version of If Bod Was One of Us. Yeah? Is that what you want to hear? Oh. You're all up for that? Good man. Give it up for Danny O'Reilly, who clearly had too good a time in Tokyo, in Japan.
Thanks, lads.
We are going to take a very quick break. We're here tonight with thanks to Heineken, official worldwide partner of Rugby World Cup Japan 2019. Don't forget to get your selfies in, hashtag OTBBGET. Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay.
All right, he's going to be back. All our special guests are going to be back, and we're going to have Malcolm O'Kelly as well, and we're going to look ahead to the weekend, but we're going to take a short break, all right? Thank you very much.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.